From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, President Biden's $2 trillion infrastructure plan and what it means for this region.
We have a generational opportunity to invest in infrastructure, and we cannot squander it by investing in the last generation's infrastructure.
Congressman Seth Moulton talks about roads, bridges, and airports, and whether Republicans will come along for the ride. Also today, how a Jewish state senator from Massachusetts engaged a high school football team accused of using hate speech.
I showed them a picture of my family, and I said that if I was around during the 40s in Germany, people just like me would have gone into the concentration camps and died.
And the Red Sox rained out today, but we'll check the forecast for the rest of the season.
Well, we had a great spring training. We're coming off of a somewhat mediocre season last year.
It can only get better. That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks, and we'll begin today with Joe Biden's proposed infrastructure and jobs package and what it could mean for the nation and for this state and region. The first thing we need to say is this. It's huge. $2 trillion with big ambitions to match. A plan to repair 20,000 miles of road, 10,000 bridges, fix and expand public transit and rail. It would also tackle the climate crisis, racial inequality, hike corporate taxes, while putting a generation of Americans to work.
It will create millions of jobs, good-paying jobs. It will grow the economy, make us more competitive around the world, promote our national security interests, and put us in a position to win the global competition with China in the upcoming years. It's big, yes. It's bold, yes. And we can get it done.
That's Biden rolling out the plan yesterday. And to help us make sense of it all and what the plan would mean for this part of the country, we're joined by Massachusetts Congressman Seth Moulton of Salem. He represents the 6th Congressional District and serves on the House Transportation Committee. And Congressman Moulton, always great to have you on Radio Boston. Thanks for joining us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me, Anthony.
So I'm going to get into the particulars of this plan, but I'd love just a quick reaction from you, your initial reaction, your initial take on President Biden's massive proposal here.
My initial take is that this is exactly what we need. And of course, we need to see all the details. Those are still being developed. But there's no question that we have a massive infrastructure debt in this country that we've got to build back better. We have a huge opportunity coming out of the pandemic to put money into the economy, food on people's tables by giving good jobs to Americans all across the country and come out with a much better connected America at the end of the day.
So, Congressman, this is the first half of a Biden plan to do this. There's going to be another plan, part of it that will come out later for a total of $4 trillion over a decade. So things get measured these days in trillions of dollars. Republicans, of course, very concerned about these kinds of price tags. What's your response to that kind of concern?
It's amazing how unconcerned they were with the price tag of the Trump tax cut, which was trillions of dollars. And of course, that didn't go to making our country stronger, building infrastructure, preparing us for the next 100 years. Building a legacy that our kids can be proud of. No. That just went to giving tax breaks to the wealthiest Americans and the richest corporations. So their criticism is totally hypocritical. But there's bipartisan agreement that we need to put more money into infrastructure. I think the key is going to be whether we invest in next generation infrastructure. As I've often said, this is a generational opportunity to invest in infrastructure. We can't squander it by investing in the last generation's infrastructure. That's why the details matter so much.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of those details, because I'd like to understand and give listeners an idea of what it might mean to this, to our region, to this state. You've long been an advocate for better transit, building the North-South rail link, for example, high-speed rail. Would this proposal represent a boost to projects like those specific projects?
Well, it would. Yesterday, President Biden said, quote, you and your family can travel coast to coast without a single tank of gas on a high speed train. That's the reality that we should all be experiencing today. And yet we're the only developed country on earth pretty much that doesn't have high speed rail. So look, think about it this way. We can put a ton of money into 1950s highways, and maybe we'll get some electric vehicles. So you can be traveling around in a brand spanking new electric car with an added lane to Route 93, and you'll still be stuck in traffic. Or you could be zipping across Massachusetts and zipping across the entire region at 250 miles an hour in a high-speed train. Everywhere else in the world, that's how they're traveling. And so we're really behind in America. And that's what I mean by investing in next-generation infrastructure. We should be able to get more quickly to where we want to go with less impact on the environment, safer, more efficiently. Americans should have more options. And that's what we're really gunning for in this proposal.
Are there shovel-ready projects that you'd like to see get funded? I mean, we're going to talk about sort of the challenges facing this plan, getting through Congress in a moment, but let's assume it gets through. What's sort of on top of your list of particular projects here in Massachusetts?
Well, it's a good question. You know, the North-South Rail Link is unquestionably the most important infrastructure project that we need to do because it enables regional rail where you can live on the north side of Boston and work on the south side, which you can't do today. It's just unrealistic to be able to make that commute by car. And of course, the rail system is totally disconnected, so you can't do it by train. We're talking about getting around Massachusetts more quickly than you can today, not just by the commuter rail, but then you can by car. And we commissioned a study not too long ago that said that doing this project will be essential for Massachusetts' future. Now you ask, is this shovel ready? Well, all the environmental approvals are not done. It can't start tomorrow. But I think it would be a huge mistake to only focus on projects that have been in the pipeline for so long that they're shovel ready, but they've been in the pipeline for so long that they're also outdated.
So your colleague, Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, said earlier this week that Massachusetts is well placed in terms of getting some funding from this plan. And he mentioned in particular projects like an east-west rail, which would connect Boston with cities like Worcester, Springfield, and Pittsfield. So there's an example of something else that this state has badly needed and talked about for a long time.
Are you
in favor of that? Yeah.
Absolutely, Anthony. But it's actually a great example to pick apart so we can understand the implications of which way we go with this proposal, because we've been talking about east-west rail for a while. But if we do what Governor Baker is talking about, we're going to build a rail system that goes about the same speed as a rail system built in 1890. We need east-west rail that's actually high-speed rail. That's what they're building everywhere else in the world. They're not building infrastructure that with trains that go 50 or 70 miles an hour. They're building infrastructure for trains that go 250 miles an hour. Imagine being able to get to Springfield in 20 or 25 minutes. That's transformative. That means that, yeah. I mean, you can live in Springfield or Longmeadow and work in downtown Boston and have a quicker commute than many people who live in places like Weston or Salem up here on the North Shore. So that's the kind of infrastructure that we need. And by the way, if you have the North-South Rail Link connecting to East-West Rail, it means you not only get into downtown Boston, but all around the entire region.
I'm just curious about this. I mean, the prospect of modern trains that can whiz along at 200 miles per hour. I know lots of countries around the globe have trains like this. But there's also this issue, and that is folks who might be concerned about living next to train tracks where trains are zooming by at 200 miles per hour. How do you overcome local opposition? How do you make this attractive to everybody, to all stakeholders, I guess?
Well, you just need to educate them and talk about the alternatives. It's far safer to live next to a high-speed rail line than it is to live next to a highway. There's much less noise. You know, you live next to a highway, there's a constant barrage of noisy trucks going by your window. High-speed trains zip by every 20 minutes. You barely notice them. The right-of-way is much narrower than a highway, so it takes up far less space. That's one of the reasons it ultimately costs less. And it's all fenced off and secured, so there's no chance that a child could wander onto the tracks. Which, of course, is not the case with highways, which require regular access. And so there's plenty of places for people to get on highways. And that's why, sadly, That's part of the reason why so many people die on our highways every single year. The reality is that high-speed rail is very popular in other parts of the world that are familiar with it, but Americans aren't familiar with it because we don't have any high-speed trains. Now, actually, the Acela goes pretty fast. It goes 150 miles an hour through southern Massachusetts, and you don't hear people complaining about that. We're talking about trains that go a bit faster, maybe 100 miles an hour faster than the Acela. But this isn't radical. It's just a radical departure from what we're used to in America.
Right. I mean, what might be radical is to convince Republicans to come along on that high-speed train ride, if you want to put it that way. Well, I mean, Mitch McConnell, let me just get the question out, and then I want you to respond to it. I mean, no, that's fine. Mitch McConnell says the Republicans won't support Biden's infrastructure plan, and he vows to fight the Democratic agenda. I mean, he just said this very, very recently. So can the president get this passed over objections of Republicans?
I mean, has Mitch McConnell ever said he would work with us on anything? Has he ever said he'll put the interests of the country ahead of his political interests? No, he always opposes everything and always attacks Democrats. That's who Mitch McConnell is. But a lot of Republicans will listen to facts. And if we talk about why there's a better return on investment for high-speed rail versus highways, why if you have a certain transportation problem between City A and City B, you can solve it at a much better price, much less money at the end of the day by building high-speed rail as opposed to adding lanes to highways, then people will come along because it just makes sense. Now, Microsoft is seeing the reality of this. There's a company that understands numbers. They actually commissioned a study themselves in the Pacific Northwest, and they found that building in a brand new, entirely new high-speed rail system to connect cities Washington and Oregon and up even into British Columbia would be far less money than adding just a single lane to the existing interstate. And think about the difference for travelers. You could add a single lane. It's going to get filled up real quickly. And at most, you're still going 70 miles an hour if there's not traffic. Whereas you have a brand new high-speed rail system for less money, and you go three times as fast.
But just to come back to this issue about Republican opposition, I mean, the Democrats pushed the stimulus bill through without a single Republican vote. Is this going to be another case where Democrats are going to have to do this on their own?
Well, I certainly hope not. You know, I have the most ambitious high-speed rail proposal before Congress right now. It's called the American High-Speed Rail Act. And I'm working to get Republicans on board so that it is bipartisan. One of the other things we have to help Republicans understand is the difference that this can make for all the intermediate cities across the country. Take Chicago and Atlanta, for example. A lot of people think of Chicago and Atlanta as a journey you could only do by plane. But actually, they're closer together than Beijing and Shanghai, the most popular high-speed rail route in China right now. And travelers over there, whether they're Chinese travelers or American travelers, and they can choose to go by plane between those two cities. But overwhelmingly, they choose high-speed rail because it's a much nicer, better way to travel. But if we just invested in O'Hara Airport in Chicago and Hartsfield-Jackson in Atlanta, that might be good for those two economies. But it wouldn't do anything for Indianapolis. It wouldn't do anything for Nashville or Chattanooga. And yet all those smaller cities, many of them in Republican districts, would be served by regular high-speed rail service between Atlanta and Chicago. So it would be brilliant for all these economies in between, for so many cities that have been left out of the tech and biotech revolution in places like Boston or the economic booms that Atlanta and Chicago have experienced, but haven't been felt by everywhere in the Midwest. That's part of the vision that we need to explain to skeptical Republicans.
Congressman, I have to say, I've talked to you about many issues over the years, and sometimes you're, really enthusiastic, and sometimes you're really enthusiastic. And I got to say, this seems like an issue that seems to really light your fire. This is the sense I'm getting.
Well, the reason I think, Anthony, is because of what a difference it makes well beyond transportation. I mean, this is not just about having a nicer way to get from here to there. I mean, high-speed rail is nicer, and that's why business travelers prefer it. But this is about what it means for our communities, because it incentivizes the kind of smart, beautiful downtown cities, smart, sustainable growth that we all want. It means that the country will be more tied together, and people won't feel so separated because they can't have access to the jobs in one of these fast growing cities. Yes, it's way better for the environment. Yes, it's way safer. And yeah, it's nicer, but it does all these other things too.
All right, Congressman Seth Moulton, he represents the Massachusetts 6th District. Congressman, always good to talk to you. Many thanks. I appreciate it.
Same here, Anthony. Take care.
In Duxbury, Mass., there are still questions around the disturbing story of the high school varsity football team accused last week of using anti-Semitic language. The school fired the head coach and is conducting an investigation into exactly what the football players said. They allegedly used words like dreidel, rabbi, and Auschwitz to call plays on the field. Among those who took action right away was Barry Feingold. He's the Democratic state senator representing parts of Lawrence and Andover, and he's Jewish. He wrote an open letter inviting the team to meet with him, which they did over the weekend. We spoke to State Senator Feingold earlier today, and I asked him what his first reaction was after he heard the reports of what the football players said.
It was a double take, and I just was shocked because as a former football player, I've heard Omaha, I've heard Ric Flair, I've heard Lincoln, I've heard Nebraska, but this was something totally different and unfortunately not very good.
Right. Now, first, I want to ask you about the open letter that you wrote to the team inviting them to talk to you. Was that an easy decision to make?
It was for a couple of reasons. One, the sport of football has been very good to me. It is what I believe was the reason why I was able to get into college. I what I explained to the members of the team is that I was on the bench my sophomore and junior year, but I had a breakout season my senior year. And that, what I believe, got me into a school like Franklin Marshall. And the reason why I brought that story up was to relate to the students, because I know so many of these students, you know, thought they wouldn't even have a season. And for them, you know, the fall season was canceled, and now they had a second chance at it this spring. So I understood how disappointing it was that they might lose their season. So we had that connectivity. But at the same time, you know, Judaism is really important to me. You know, this week I'm celebrating Passover. All of my kids have been bar mitzvahed. I've been bar mitzvahed. And, you know, Judaism has been a very important part of my life. So it was a situation where two of my greatest loves collided. And that's why I wanted to have a conversation with these students.
So you met with the team virtually this past Saturday, I understand. Give us a
Correct.
Sense of what that meeting looked like and how it went forward.
Well, really what I wanted to do is I wanted them to connect with my story, but I also pivoted to tell them that, you know, being a Jewish person and playing football wasn't always the easiest thing. I had a situation where, you know, the at the beginning of every game, my freshman year in college, I mean, actually throughout the college, every single member of the team would get on a knee and say the Our Father. Being Jewish, I didn't get on my knee. I stood up. So I stood out like a sore thumb. And you're a freshman and all these seniors and juniors and sophomores in front of you. So that wasn't easy. And at the same time, my sophomore year, we were playing Georgetown. It was a very big game. But it fell on the Jewish holiday of Yom Kippur. And I explained to my coach, I can't play. You know, it was drilled in my head at a very young age that Sandy Koufax didn't pitch in the World Series. So you can never play sports on, you know, Rosh Hashanah or Yom Kippur. So I've had experiences where I've felt different playing the sport, but at the same time, the game of football has been so instrumental to my life. And, you know, I just really, you know, wanted to come across and explain how much it meant to me. And then I also talked about how much Judaism meant to me as well.
And you also talked to them about some history, I mean, with respect to the Holocaust and really getting them to try to understand what they may not have been appreciating, right?
Right, right. And the reason why I did this connectivity towards football is because I wanted them to think that I was like them. But then I showed them pictures of what Auschwitz looked like. I showed them clips from Schindler's List and what I said to them. And I showed them a picture of my family. And I said that if I was around during the 40s in Germany, people just like me would have gone into the concentration camps and gone into the gas chambers and died.
Did you come away, Senator, with any sense that these young folks heard you, appreciated what you were saying, and maybe, you know, are going forward now with a different kind of point of view about all of this?
I do. And the thing that I talked about is a Jewish term called teshuvah, which means redemption. And that in the Jewish religion, we do believe in redemption. And to me, life is about looking forward. I also talked to them and I showed them a clip of Elie Wiesel, who's probably one of the most well-known spokespeople for the Holocaust. And when he was talking about the Holocaust, he says, you know, the reason why we talk about the Holocaust is not to have people feel bad for us, to give us pity, or to cry for us. The reason why we talk about the Holocaust is to make the world a better place and for all of us to be messengers. And what I was hopeful, and what I believe is that I'm hopeful that every member of this team will be messengers of good. And this will be a learning experience, a teachable moment. And in the end, I'm hopeful, in Elie Wiesel's words, that the world will be a better place.
At a certain point, as I was doing the reading for this segment, I read that you maintain that the words that these young football players used on the line of scrimmage were used out of ignorance rather than hate. And I'm wondering if you could sort of elaborate on the important difference between the two there.
Well, I think really what it turns to is a real problem beyond this team or Duxbury is the lack of education of young people in our state when it comes to genocide. 35% of all students in Massachusetts can't even name a single concentration camp. And the thing that I really stressed was that the reason why it's a big deal to make light of a word like Auschwitz is that, as we say, that those who tend to make light or forget history tend to repeat it. And what I also showed the students is that I showed them Rwanda, I showed them Bosnia, and that we in the state, and someone who's a state lawmaker, we now know we need to do a better job of educating people about genocide. And it's not even just about a Jewish genocide, it's about an Armenian genocide. It's about the killing fields in Cambodia. So I think this is also a wake-up call to all of us in elected office that we in the state of Massachusetts also need to do a better job of educating young people about this.
Yeah, and with regard to that, there's a bill currently in the state Senate that would require instruction on genocide before students graduate from high school. My guess is that you support a measure like that.
Absolutely, yeah. After seeing what I've seen, I'm now co-sponsoring the bill and, you know, want to see this move forward because it is something that as a society, as a state, we all have to do better.
Senator, I'm impressed with the way you handled this, and I just want to ask you about how you approach this issue in terms of, in the context of a big sort of contentious debate right now. You know, on the one hand, when folks engage in behavior or speech that might be considered hateful, there's a push to deplatform them, identify them. You know, in this case, maybe that might mean take them off the team. I mean, this is what we mean by cancel culture. The other approach is more about redemption, as you mentioned, forgiveness. And that's the approach that you seem to have opted for here. And I'm wondering if you can talk about that and whether you had to have a bit of a debate within yourself about which road to take.
Of course, of course. And no one is ever saying that this action is okay, that it is not egregious what happened. But I can tell you that when I was 16 or 17, I made mistakes. Right. And that people had empathy on me. And as a result of that empathy, I'm able to be here today as one of your state senators. And we have to understand that we are dealing with teenagers. We're dealing with young people and that, you know, they're not perfect. They're not fully formed adults. And I do believe empathy, sympathy, and education will go a long way. Now, it doesn't mean that what they did was right. Doesn't mean that what they did was justified. But I do believe life is about moving forward and not looking back. And once again, if we can learn from this and make people, as Elie Wiesel says, messengers of good, then to me, what the whole thing would be worth it. And then what we want set out to do would be accomplished.
That was Barry Feingold. He's a Massachusetts Democratic state senator who we spoke to earlier today. Next, a story about a family, kids, and identity.
I'm Hallel of Massachusetts, of the United States, and I am a boy girl.
That announcement to parents Shira and Ari was 3 years ago. Hallel, now 9, is the oldest of 3 children. Through a series of family recordings and interviews with WBUR's Martha Biebinger, they shared the story of how this revelation unfolded and what they're still learning.
Do you remember?
Well, Hallel was crying.
Yeah.
Right, Hallel was crying, and I, you know, we said, what's wrong? And Hallel said, well, Yara and I are playing parents, and Yara says that she's the mommy and that you're the daddy, meaning Hallel is the daddy, and that doesn't feel right because I'm a boy girl.
Yeah.
And so it felt a little bit like getting up to the top of a roller coaster, where you know, like, okay, now it's going to begin, and I don't know exactly what's going to happen next, but what I do know for sure is that this is happening. Hallel had been gender nonconforming in some way for many years. And you know, I think we had asked ourselves, that was Hallel transgender? Was Hallel a girl? And that didn't quite feel right either.
And we were always trying to come up with this calculation of, like, Hallel's acting girl-like, Hallel's acting boy-like. Oh, but what a relief. Hallel has acted boy-like for the past 3 weeks. So maybe this is going to stick.
Make the introduction.
Okay. We're making a recording. Okay, Hallel. Can you tell me what it feels like to be a boy girl?
That's a hard question. Like, I just feel like myself, and that's it. I don't feel that different from anybody else.
What about you as a boy?
So first of all, there's nothing specifically for boys or girls. I just feel like a girl as well as a boy.
Yeah, and I guess the question is, how do you describe that you knew one day that you felt like both a boy and a girl? It's hard, isn't it?
I don't remember it that well. Can you? Do you think you remember a bit better?
Well, I don't. I'll tell you about myself, which is that I always knew that I was just a girl. And it's weird because, you know, people ask somebody who's trans or who's non-binary, well, how do you know that you're trans? That would be like somebody asking me, well, Shira, how do you know that you're a girl? It's something that you know deep down inside.
Something that you choose, and it's something that you know.
So I understand the it's something that you know, but what do you mean it's something that you choose?
You don't choose your gender at birth, but that doesn't stop you from changing your gender eventually. Or changing genders if you're a boy girl. Mm-hmm.
So do you think your parents made a mistake about what your gender was when you were born?
Yeah, but that's normal. Like, I couldn't express and I didn't feel like a boy girl yet.
Okay. So I'm going to turn this off for the night, all right, puppy?
Ari and I found out that Hallel was going to be a quote-unquote boy because they saw a penis on the ultrasound. And so we just marched forward with this impression of what our life with a boy was going to be like. And clearly it was nowhere near what I envisioned, not the least of which is also Hallel being on the autism spectrum, which has created another wave of difference in our family. We parents trick ourselves into thinking that we have everything figured out, that we know what our story is going to look like because of these very basic indicators, and I just think it's such a fallacy.
So, Hallel, I want you to read the title of this article, and I'm curious what you think.
they is the word of the year. Merriam-Webster says, nothing, it's singular.
Noting its singular rise. Oh. So let me read you this first paragraph. Merriam-Webster announced the pronoun they as its word of the year, marking the rise of the use of the venerable plural pronoun to refer to a single person whose gender identity is non-binary. So what do you think about that?
Wow.
Why wow?
Maybe, like, next year, they will be in the dictionary.
I think it is in the dictionary already.
Already?
It took a while before you started really saying, I want to be called they.
Yeah, about a month.
And now we're all very, very clear about what the pronoun is for you.
Grandma and Papa.
Well, Grandma and Papa are working on it. I know, it's frustrating. It's okay.
So, Halal, I think it's so automatic. We say he or she or they or it almost every single sentence that we say something. So it's like we have a lot of practice using it in one way.
Last night, I figured out how I would make it easier for my teachers, your grandma and grandpa and stuff, to understand. I could just tell them, refer to me as a group of people. Say they are, or I know them.
Sometimes I have those monochrome days, but other days I have pastel, neon. I think I probably wear more pants, but I do love skirts. Dresses, oh, I love dresses. I wear those all the time.
There was, I think, an internal squeamishness I had about having Halal wear dresses to school. And I realized it's just because it was different and something I wasn't used to. But they have taken such pride in who they are and in telling people.
People usually assume that I'm a girl. If it's someone that I'm probably not going to see very often, I just don't correct them. But usually I correct them.
Remember when we were in the airport in Hawaii and I said, Halal, you're wearing a dress. I don't think you should be going into the men's room even though there's no line. Do you remember that?
Well, I really had to go.
So I was just nervous that somebody was going to tell you that you had to leave.
But I thought, like, all those questions become laws.
So we know that you're protected in Massachusetts, but we have to do our research to understand what the protection is in other states. And that's the part that's a little scary, you know? We want you to be protected.
Some days, I made a schedule. On Mondays, Thursdays, and Fridays, I go into the boys' or men's bathroom. And on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Saturday, I go into the women's bathroom. And on Sunday, I just go to whatever bathroom's to my right.
Really? I don't think I knew the Sunday rule, but that's pretty amazing. I'm very worried about what Halal's future will look like. My kid affirmed who they are, and I made the choice to either accept them or reject them, and I decided to accept them. But what's that going to look like when Halal is 11, 12, 13, adolescence? I hope it's going to be wonderful. I don't know, though.
I don't really want to think about that stuff. Because now is now, and I'll know when I live it.
So is there anything else that you want to say as part of this conversation before I give you a kiss and you go to sleep?
No, how about you?
I think what I want to say is I just love you exactly how you are. I loved you when you were born exactly how you were, and I love you now exactly how you are.
You know you recorded that.
I did record it, yeah.
Our story about Hillel was produced by WBUR's Martha Biebinger, and Martha joins us now to talk about it. Martha, great to have you, and wonderful work on that story. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthony.
I want to ask you about a couple of things. I was struck in particular about the use of pronouns as being an important part of this. Talk a little bit about why so important.
Well, people are changing their pronouns and using pronouns like they, as you heard is the case with Hillel. There's just a lot more fluidity with pronouns these days. And they're really important, of course, because they're a key part of someone's identity, like calling them the right name. So to be respectful, we want to be sure we use the pronouns that represent somebody's identity.
Right. Now, the story shed light on some of the complications around that. I mean, Hillel referred to the fact that not everybody across the generations is so on earth with this. And I'm thinking of their grandparents, for example, having a hard time adjusting to this. How do we help folks think about this and support folks who have made this, who have come to this recognition about who they are?
Well, so first, Anthony, you're right, it is generational. But in Hillel's case, their sister, their younger sister, is actually one of the members of the family who had a hard time for quite a while. So Amazingly, in this family, the dad, Ari, as you heard, studies linguistics. And I'll just tell you a little bit about how he described his approach to me. So in short, Ari says that he has been very patient with himself. And here's why. As he studies it, our brains repeatedly connect a person and a pronoun, thousands, maybe millions of times with a close friend or family member. So making that connection, for me, it's subconscious to say Anthony him. Like I've known you so long, like I don't even think about it. It's embedded in the mechanics of my brain. So to reprogram those circuits, as Ari explains, if you changed your pronoun today, I need some time to do that rewiring. And that explains why people who use a different pronoun for Hillel, for the first 6 years of their life have had a hard time changing to they, and maybe helps some of the rest of us understand why it can be difficult to change the pronoun when we're asked to with somebody who is transitioning.
Martha, it was moving to listen to just how supportive and how loving the parents are to Hillel, and that's obviously understandable. This is their child, obviously. But I'm just wondering if there are debates among professionals about how to approach this situation, or is this family really doing it exactly the way it should be done? I mean, is there any debate about this?
So the families of trans and non-binary kids are very well of the research that shows higher rates of depression, anxiety, and in some cases, young people and adults as well hurting themselves because they aren't accepted. So in the mental health community, Anthony, there's not really much debate about this. Acceptance is really the thing that can counter a lot of that stress, showing an interest in the person's experience, asking whatever they're comfortable sharing, just showing compassion. The family in this case really said compassion is the thing that they kind of crave from people.
Sure.
Now, of course, we know that there are conservative religious and political groups debating the acceptance of people who are trans and non-binary, and we're seeing that play out in state legislatures. But in the mental health field, no, there's not really a lot of debate.
All right. Well, that's WBUR's Martha Biebinger. Martha, thank you so much for that reporting. And listeners, you can go to WBUR.org and see and read a lot more about this story. There are interviews and pictures, more reporting from Martha. And stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Well, that's what we thought we'd be hearing from Fenway Park right about now. It was supposed to be opening day for the Red Sox. The weather had other ideas after pouring rain last night and this morning. The game has been postponed until tomorrow. The forecast looking much better. But after a dark and gloomy 2020, how about the team's forecast for the coming season? Well, we're going to spend a little time talking about that. Let's check the score with Radio Boston's Chris Sidorek. Hey, Chris, great to have you.
Hey, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
I always like talking baseball with you. Also joining us is ESPN senior writer and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday, Howard Bryant. Howard, welcome back to Radio Boston. Great to have you as well.
Thanks. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, but I have to say I'm just not really feeling it this year. Chris, let me start with you. I mean, there have been so many high-profile departures, and this Red Sox team, I don't know. I don't know how to get my arms around this sort of group of irregulars. It just feels really strange to me. Help me out.
Yeah, I might be the wrong one to ask because I've officially been boycotting this team since the Mookie trade. So I'm going to delegate a little bit here.
Hashtag where's Mookie?
That's what I'm saying. No, I'm going to delegate a little bit here. I'm going to play a little bit of Tom Warner, the Red Sox chairman, who was on CNBC's Squawk Box this morning. He's going to tell you why you should get excited.
Well, we had a great spring training. We're coming off of a somewhat mediocre season last year, but I think we've upgraded our staff and our squad. And, you know, baseball in spring is always an exciting combination. I'm really excited that we're having fans at Fenway Park. I know you mentioned that we only have 12% capacity, but we haven't had fans at Fenway Park in 18 months.
So
So fans at Fenway Park, that's a big deal. Yeah, but go ahead, Chris.
Yeah, I was going to say a lot there to unpack. That. I mean, spring and baseball.
Somewhat mediocre last season. Somewhat mediocre, as in last place.
Yeah, pretty pitiful showing last year. I think they're hoping they can get out to a hot start and try to catch some attention here. But we'll see if they've got lightning in a bottle this year.
What do you think, Howard? Lightning in a bottle? Or what do you see on this reconstituted Red Sox squad?
Well, I think that even more so than what you see on the roster, there's an emotional healing that hasn't quite taken place yet. People aren't done mourning. I think that we have been extremely spoiled in New England in that there's one philosophy that you have in baseball more than any other sport, because the sport doesn't have really a salary cap. And it is, there are certain teams that should always compete, and the Red Sox are one of them. The Red Sox should always be one of the teams that is, you know, that when the Red Sox lose players, they don't lose players because they can't afford them. The Red Sox lose players because they chose not to sign them. Red Sox, right. Yankees, Dodgers, those are the teams that are in that category. And I think people are really struggling with the fact that how did the Red Sox let this happen? And so because of that, it creates that lack of enthusiasm is a byproduct of wondering why this happened in the first place. Now, on the field, for what you've got, you don't have Chris Sale back yet. So you're not sure what J.D. Martinez is going to give you. You know, Devers and Bogarts, those are sort of the mainstays that you've got. And of course, you know, it's, you know, J.D. Martinez is the big guy in the lineup, but you just don't go into this season knowing what you can count on. You're not even going to get Chris Sale back to the All-Star break.
Right, right. So, Chris, back to you. What are the biggest changes from last year? Howard outlined some there. I mean, obviously, people like Mookie Betts are gone. Jackie Bradley Jr., who gave, you know, Willie Mays a run for his money out there in center field, he's gone. A bunch of people are gone. David Price, long gone.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting.
Benintendi, gone.
You're looking at the Chaim Bloom playbook here, right? This is what he does, basically. It's not about the big-name players. It's about finding value where you can and finding guys that you think will overperform their worth, basically. It's Moneyball on steroids. But I think the biggest change this year is probably depth in starting rotation and bullpen. They were so hurting for pitching last year. They at least are going into the season with five starting pitchers on the roster. That's a change, believe it or not, from last year. So they've added some arms. I think health is still going to be a huge question mark for those guys. Eduardo Rodriguez was supposed to be the opening day pitcher. He's already on the IL now for a dead arm. So that's scary to hear. We'll see how the pitching can hold up, but I think they're hopeful that they can at least stay in games longer than they did last year. Last year was just such a dumpster fire that I think basically if they can be somewhat competitive, the ownership will probably be happy with it, to be honest.
Yeah, and I actually tend to think that it's not Moneyball on steroids. It's Moneyball on water. I mean, they don't – it's just a glass of water with them because – The Red Sox, once again,
they don't want to pay for the steroids.
Teams,
that's why.
Right. That are supposed to be competing. Look, the Dodgers tried this years ago when they went and got Paul D. Podesta to put Moneyball in a big market. Moneyball in a big market doesn't work unless you spend. You still have to spend. And so if you're going to, you know, you can't fool a Boston fan. And if you're sending the message that you're going to try to rebuild and retool and be smarter than everybody, and then pare down the payroll and do a whole Tampa Bay Rays thing, people are going to see through that. This is Boston. You need big players. You need stars. And you know, it's going to be real interesting to see what the appetite is for a true rebuild. Boston hasn't really had to do that very often. They've had bad seasons, but it's never like, okay, we're paring guys down and we're not spending to get players anymore. That hasn't happened in a decade.
Yeah, that's so interesting to hear, Howard. And I want to highlight that by playing a little bit of Alex Cora, who was talking to reporters on Tuesday, the last day of spring training, really driving this point home.
It's been good, but it's time to hop on that plane and, you know, this is the end of this, but it starts on Thursday and in a division that is a very tough one. And everybody knows about three teams and everybody have their feelings about us and the Orioles. We just got to, you know, work, keep grinding, keep getting better. And if we do that, we're going to be in good shape.
I was so blown away to hear that, because how often have we gone into a year where you're saying, okay, there are three teams in this division everybody's aware of, and then there's us and the Orioles at the back end? That's
exactly.
Wild. That's wild.
Right, so he's talking about the Yankees. Who's he talking about? He's talking about the Yankees.
The Rays and the Blue Jays.
The Rays and the Blue Jays.
Rays and the Blue Jays. And right. And so the Red Sox don't even rate.
And to say that's your top tier. Yeah. And then we're here at the cellar dwellers with the Orioles. That is crazy to me as Howard is driving home. A major market team that has all the money they could want to spend on these players. It's just a really interesting, to put it lightly, way to run an organization.
Well, Howard,
and the message being sent is be prepared for a rebuild. And I think that one of the questions here is that if you're John Henry and if you're the Boston Red Sox, you can probably also make the argument to believe in that haven't we put enough reserve in the bank? We got you four championships in 20 years. So we're going, you know, we're asking you to trust us. It's not like we're asking you to believe in us and we haven't delivered, but it's very, very clear that the Red Sox, you look at the money, you look at Mookie went and got $380 million. You look at the Lindor deal, $341. You look at Tatis, you look at the money that is out there right now. The Red Sox aren't players for handing out $375 million contracts these days.
So I'm curious, Howard, a couple of times you've mentioned the idea of rebuild and a team that's rebuilding. The Red Sox aren't really acknowledging that, right? They get uncomfortable if you say, we're rebuilding, right? This team is rebuilding. That's what's happening. No. We're putting a competitive team on the field. I mean, they're not actually embracing that idea of rebuild. Is that just about sort of marketing?
No, I don't think it's marketing. I think it's the fact that they still have three or four players who were championship players on that team. So that doesn't feel like a rebuild. You still have Devers, who's a great, really, really good player. You've got Bogaerts, who's supposed to be one of the best players in the league at his position. You still have Chris Sale. You still have JD Martinez. So at the end of the day, they're like, listen, we've got enough of a foundation here that this is not a teardown. At the same time, I think it's as much emotional as anything else, too, in that if you just go back a few years, you're talking about Betts, Benintendi, Bradley. You're making comparisons to the old 75 outfield where you get emotionally attached to these guys, and this thing disappeared really fast. That idea that this team was going to stick around for a while, I mean, they won the World Series in 2018. And so the emotional detachment that now you're looking at this team without those guys, it's a pretty harsh fall, even though there is talent on the roster.
Yeah, and I think that's what's really ringing with fans is that that seems so recent that we had that really fun team that just plowed through the regular season, winning all these games, wins the championship, and then to see these guys shipped out of town one after the other, it is kind of disheartening as a fan.
Well, disheartening. And I guess we have to just be content with this season's motto, we can only get better. Right?
Keep grinding.
Oh, boy. It's going to be a long summer, Anthony.
All right. That's Howard Bryant, ESPN senior writer and sports correspondent for NPR's Weekend Edition. Thanks, Howard. Good to have you.
Thank you. Thank you, Anthony. See you, Chris.
And our own Chris Siderick, Radio Boston's Chris Siderick. Chris, always good to talk to you.
Thanks. Always fun and good to be on with you, too, Howard.
And that's it for today. Radio Boston's produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wuthman, with help from Steve Gelman. Our engineer today, Renee Marchando. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Anthony Brooks.